You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Coming up, the Evers administration is proposing new groundwater quality standards for 27 substances that can threaten public health. We break down the details and discuss how the process for strengthening the standards works.
Right now, a new proposal from a radio industry group is aiming to make changes that could impact what we hear on commercial stations.
The National Association of Broadcasters is hoping to relax the rules governing how many commercial radio stations a single company can own in a given market.
The Federal Communications Commission hasn't made a decision on whether or not to approve the change, but the idea has some observers worried about the negative effect it could potentially have on local radio and emerging artists.
Kevin Erickson is the director of the Future of Music Coalition, a nonprofit education, research, and advocacy group for musicians. Kevin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what would this proposal from the National Association of Broadcasters change about the rules of radio station ownership as we know it?
So currently, the number of stations a single company can own in a single market is based on how many radio stations there are overall in that geographic market. So, for example, in a market with like 45 radio stations, a single company can own up to 8 stations. For a smaller market, between 15 and 29 radio stations, a single company can own up to 6 stations, and it continues downward after that. The National Association of Broadcasters has proposed to throw all that out. And so in the top 75 markets, a single company could own up to 10 FM stations and unlimited AM stations. And then in any of the smaller markets, a single company could own as many radio stations as it wants to. So in Milwaukee, for example, Milwaukee is one of the top 75. And so in Milwaukee, a single company could own 10 FM stations and unlimited AM stations. But in Madison, a single company could own as many stations as it wants. It would actually be legal for a single company to own every commercial radio station.
So I want to get back to sort of the broader implications this has for potentially the music industry and take a step back and look at the fact that this didn't simply happen overnight. This has kind of been in the works for, I'd say, you know, more than 20 years at this point. You know, the Telecommunications Act of 1996, you know, kind of opened the doors for this to happen. What did we see, I guess, prior to 1996 and to now?
Well, prior to 1996, you know, I think there was a much stronger possibility that as a local musician, you could just walk into a local radio station and say, here's my new single. Would you consider it for airplay? And now, as there's less and less investment, you know, radio makes money from selling advertising. And so when they centralize ownership, they can cut costs to drive the rates down. And so that makes it harder for truly local and independent stations to compete because they don't have the same efficiencies of scale. So when they're chasing those efficiencies of scale, that means that they tend to replace local talent with out-of-town and pre-recorded DJs. And so we've seen loss of jobs. You know, sometimes they replace those people with national programmers. Often they're just replaced with robots. And so we've lost the ability to just walk into a physical building and just say, hello, music director. This is the music that I've been working on. But we've also lost the ability to have people that are programming radio being embedded in their local communities. But there's a potential for it to get much, much worse if this rule change goes through.
We're talking to Kevin Erickson right now. He is the director of the Future of Music Coalition. It's a nonprofit education, research, and advocacy group for musicians. And he's with us to talk about the growing trend of small radio consolidation in the United States. And you were saying that, you know, this has the potential to get worse. You know, we've talked about, you know, sort of a lack of diversity on the airwaves. How do you see it getting worse if, you know, these big companies, say iHeart, which is owned by Clear Channel, Cumulus, end up owning, you know, way more stations than they currently already do?
Right. Well, I mean, the truly crazy thing to realize is that this isn't even good business. We actually saw both Clear Channel, now renamed iHeartRadio, and Cumulus, which were really the companies that paved the way for this business model. They actually both been bankrupt, but not before transforming the entire radio landscape and moving radio away from the live and the local focus. I think that at the level of the smaller station groups, it drives them more and more the same direction. So there's less room for the few remaining independent players, the smaller station groups, the companies that can remain accountable to their local communities to continue to compete. Helps propagate sort of the worst practices of the bigger companies. And so what we're left with is a tiny handful of companies controlling more and more of what we are able to hear. As a result of that, there's fewer opportunities for musicians, sure, but there's also less opportunity to hear even local news content. Because there's less of an incentive to invest the dollars in producing that kind of content.
You know, if you're saying that this is a bad business move for these companies, then, you know, what arguments have they been making to pursue this consolidation? Because there's clearly a goal in mind. So I guess what's being missed here?
Well, so I think that... because we're since 1996, we've been in this deregulatory environment where the Federal Communications Commission, the federal agency that has jurisdiction over our telecommunications infrastructure, has allowed more and more consolidation across industries, and that has driven the entire industry more and more in the direction of consolidation. And I would say that ownership consolidation is a problem across music businesses and across adjacent businesses, but really across our entire economy, fewer and fewer companies having more and more power. In this context, the argument that has been made by the big broadcasters is that, well, there's all these new digital services, and to compete with the digital services, we need to get rid of the regulations that govern what we call terrestrial broadcasting, AM and FM stations. From our perspective, though, from the musician's perspective, well, the appropriate thing to do with the new challenges presented by digital services, by digital music streaming, and is to look at what the appropriate regulatory scheme for those companies are, not throw out the remaining public interest protections that we still enjoy.
So I guess if we can just take a look right now really quickly at digital streaming, because that has gotten really big. It has been something that people go to now more than those terrestrial radio options, FM, you know, their car radio. How much has that impacted, I guess, musicians in particular, from your perspective?
Well, streaming platforms certainly are experiencing a lot of growth. They are able to feature a much broader variety of music than commercial radio. And unlike commercial radio, they actually pay musicians a little bit of money. Terrestrial radio, many people don't know this, terrestrial radio doesn't actually pay musicians and performers at all. At the same time, some of these music platforms have likewise been criticized for paying very little. Other digital services like Bandcamp have more equitable and fairly remunerative revenue models. But digital businesses are subject to the same problems of consolidation and can replicate some of these the most problematic trends towards consolidation. We just saw the merger of SiriusXM and Pandora, for example. What digital platforms can't do for all of the potential that they have, what they can't reproduce are the elements that make radio truly special, which is the ability to be live and local. The ability to have your ear to the ground. And that's worth defending. We can celebrate the growth that's happening in digital music, encourage these emerging models to be more accountable to communities and more responsible in how they treat musicians. But at the same time, it's an ecosystem, and radio still has incredible potential, too, if we protect it from the consolidation.
So this is just right now a proposal from the National Association of Broadcasters, which is what we've been talking about. What are the next steps in determining whether this does or doesn't become a law?
So the FCC, every 4 years, as part of its broad review of its governance of media ownership, looks at the existing ownership rules and decides whether or not they ought to be changed. So the proposal from the big broadcasters has been put forward in that context as part of this review that happens every 4 years. Now, what we've seen in the last few cycles is an FCC that's especially under the current leadership is an FCC that's got people who are eager to roll back some of these protections. The FCC has five members. They get to vote about a rule change, but then their decisions can be challenged in court and have been. Most recently, the last iteration of this process, another attempt to roll back media ownership rules. They just had the oral arguments in that case in a federal court, and we're waiting on the verdict to that. That may have implications for whether this plan is allowed to move forward. But in addition to the courts having oversight over the FCC and being one place where or it's possible for consolidation to be kept in check, Congress has oversight over the FCC. And so Congress can exercise that oversight by asking that the FCC do some studies, make sure that if they're going to consider such a radical change to the broadcasting landscape, we need to have good data so we understand what the impact on playlists is, so we understand what the impact on ownership diversity might be, so we understand how these changes will impact communities. Right now, we don't even have the commission is considering these radical changes without really having a strong understanding of even the changes that they've already made, dating back to 1996.
Well, Kevin, we'll have to leave it there for now, but thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about this issue.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great day.
Kevin Erickson is the director of the Future of Music Coalition. That's a nonprofit education, research, and advocacy group for musicians. He was with us to talk about a proposal from the National Association of Broadcasters that would let companies own more radio stations in certain media markets.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Coming up, a U.S. House committee debated last week over the issue of reparations for descendants of slaves. We discussed the changing political fight over reparations and what a program could look like.
First, a number of state agencies are recommending new groundwater quality standards in Wisconsin as state officials and lawmakers continue to respond to growing concerns about possible contaminants.
Last week, the Evers administration announced recommendations for 27 substances identified as a threat to public health. And now the State Department of Natural Resources will begin the rulemaking process to set new standards.
Rich Kramer is a reporter for WPR based in Eau Claire, and he's been covering the story. Rich, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I want to start with the process here. The administration is proposing new groundwater quality standard recommendations. That's the key word. But what exactly does that mean?
So it's the beginning of a very, very long process. What happened was the DNR came up with a list of these 27 compounds and chemicals, and they asked the Department of Health Services to kind of look into the literature to see, possible health effects that would be a result of these chemicals. And Department of Health Services basically did a lot of literature reviews, so they looked up all the scientific data they could find. The agency said they reviewed over 5,000 scientific findings. So then the Department of Health Services came up with standards, basically. They wanted to come up with the health, the safe levels for these chemicals if they were found in groundwater. And DHS referred those recommendations to DNR, and now the DNR begins the process of setting those standards into state statute, which is a lengthy process. I mean, it could take a couple of years.
And we mentioned the 27 substances identified here. A big part of that is something called PFAS, which we've been hearing a lot about recently. Can you remind us what these PFAS compounds are?
Sure, you're going to make me try to pronounce it.
We had the same discussion at home.
Sure, polyfluoroalkyl alkyl substances, and so we'll just stick to PFAS. But they're human-made chemicals. They're found in products, things like nonstick cookware, fast food wrappers, firefighting foam, stain-resistant sprays. You know, clothing that has where the water just beads up and runs right off of you. Those are the types of items that could have these chemicals in there. And basically, these are chemicals that we're still learning about, that the potential impact. And that's kind of what the DNR is trying to get ahead of right now, and the DHS.
So we won't have time to get into every single recommendation that's being issued for all of these chemicals. So let's focus in on PFAS in particular. What are these recommendations calling for in terms of PFAS and regulation?
So we're talking about parts per trillion here, but the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, has a standard of 70 parts per trillion. The recommendation from Department of Health Services to the DNR is to set it at 20, and that was a question that came up during the press conference. Someone asked, why 20? And the answer from Elizabeth Kleesner of the DNR was that, you know, whatever we set it at, we need to set some kind of a state standard because currently there's not one. So she made it sound like it's kind of the beginning of a discussion process. But I think that number will come up again when lawmakers start to take a look at this.
We are talking with Rich Kramer. He is a reporter for WPR based in Eau Claire, and we are talking about groundwater issues and potential new standards coming down the line. And let's talk a little bit about, timeline. You said we could have this tangled up for years. Let's start with the public. What opportunities will there be for the public to weigh in on these recommendations?
So whenever the DNR comes up with a rule, there's a lot of opportunities for public input. They first have to come up with a preliminary rule. Then it goes through, in the spring, there are the Conservation Congress hearings. It has to go before the DNR or the Natural Resources Board. So throughout the process, public comments are taken. So that process takes a while on its own. And then once the Department of Natural Resources comes up with a rule, and if the Natural Resources Board approves it, it still is subject to another layer of approval from lawmakers. And in this case, it would be the Joint Committee on Review of Administrative Rules. And they can unilaterally put the kibosh on this.
Sure. And I'm guessing that by the time that any of these proposals, once, you know, made concrete, would actually make it to the legislature, we might have different members of the legislature there. We might have a different party in power. So what do we know about what both Democrats and Republicans have said in terms of supporting potentially some of these proposals?
Well, there's been support for setting standards on both sides of the aisle in Wisconsin. Alberta Darling, for one, has said that the state needs to have some sort of standards. Democrats are for it, too. But I wanted to get a hold of the office of State Senator Steve Noss. He's a Republican from Whitewater, and he's one of the co-chairs of this Joint Committee for Review of Administrative Rules. And I was interested in talking with him because he recently, at the end of last year, basically the committee stopped emergency rules that were proposed by the DNR that had to do with chronic wasting disease and hunting, those sorts of things. So the committee said that that would be confusing for hunters. That's a whole nother story. So I thought, you know, potentially this would be a roadblock for these rules. Mm. So I reached out to this chief of staff, Mike Michelson, and he didn't really say one way or the other whether or not they would support this, but he brought up the cost, the potential cost. So this has the potential to cost a lot of money for companies, public well systems. I mean, if there's a standard and he said there may not even be technology to address these chemicals because this field is still pretty new. So it's not really a straight answer one way or the other, but it's kind of what I would expect to see more discussion about is the cost.
Well, we'll have to kind of keep an eye on that. And I'm also wondering, Rich, you know, you mentioned DNR Deputy Secretary Elizabeth Kleesner. She noted in the announcement about, you know, the recommendations moving to the policy writing timeline that the groundwater quality standards in the state haven't been updated in 10 years. And I'm wondering if she gave any indication as to, you know, cost may have been the factor as to why that was.
She didn't explicitly say it, but she did say that, you know, the agency and the Governor Evers, they're basically said they're taking these things more seriously. And so what's between the lines there is that former Governor Scott Walker was no fan of regulations, especially when it had the potential to increase the cost of businesses and local governments. So, they didn't say exactly why these standards weren't reviewed in the last 10 years, but that seems to be what they were alluding to.
And briefly, Rich, before we wrap up, you know, we talked about how this could take years, but is there any way for the DNR to get around that long time frame if they thought, okay, we really need to do something about this?
Well, there sure is. There's the emergency rulemaking process, but even that, it's not like you snap your fingers and, you know, you can start enforcing these standards. That's another process where it's faster, but you propose an emergency rule. It has to be approved by the Natural Resources Board, and then it also is subject to the approval of the Joint Committee on Review of Administrative Rules. But even that has limitations because if you enact, there's 150 days from when the emergency rule goes into effect to when it expires. So it's just a temporary sort of thing. And I think the agencies feel that the best way forward is to create a permanent rule to have these things on the books.
Well, Rich, I look forward to talking to you over the next 2 to 3 years as we follow this going forward.
Likewise.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Rich Kramer, WPR's reporter based in Eau Claire, and he was with us today to talk about new groundwater quality standards being proposed by the Evers administration.
Coming up, we'll talk to a legal and racial justice expert about the growing calls for reparations as a way to fight the wrong of slavery in the United States. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Chris Molina. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Coming up tomorrow after 6:30 on The Morning Show, Wisconsin Life host Maureen McCollum joins Kate to talk about her year-long project working with students at a local charter school. A teacher joins them to share the experience, what it was like for the students, and more. That's tomorrow morning at 6:30 here on the Ideas Network.
First, a U.S. House of Representatives subcommittee met last week to discuss the issue of reparations for slavery.
The hearing was the second time reparations have been debated in the House, drawing some high-profile testimony from proponents like actor Danny Glover and author Ta-Nehisi Coates.
It also marks a shift in the political debate over reparations. A number of Democratic presidential hopefuls have included proposals for reparations as part of their platforms. However, some lawmakers have recently voiced opposition to the issue.
Catherine Franke is a professor of law, gender, and sexuality studies at Columbia University. She's also the author of Repair, Redeeming the Promise of Abolition. Catherine, welcome to Central Time.
Jay, it's so nice to be with you.
So, just to start it off, how significant is it that this House subcommittee is looking at reparations?
Well, 30 years ago, Representative John Conyers introduced a bill to study the issue of reparations and to make recommendations to Congress about how we might deliver reparations for slavery. And this is really the first time that the Congress has taken this issue up seriously. Representative Conyers, as you know, is retired from the Congress. But Representative Barbara Lee has taken it up, and it's just an incredible and very moving thing that we're having this national conversation about a history that has really never healed in this country.
So set the stage a little bit for us about, obviously this is a very broad topic, reparations, but in a very narrow, I guess, bite-sized way, what are we talking about when we talk about reparations?
Well, I think we're talking about a number of different things. And I think specifically, some people think about white people writing checks to black people. And though there, as Ta-Nehisi Coates said, there may be some checks written, really, I think what we're talking about is a collective reckoning with the horror of slavery and the way in which it was never fully abolished. So that could include a transfer of money as a kind of recognition of the injury, the horror of slavery. But I also think that there deserves to be a kind of national recognition in the form of an apology for the enslavement of black people, a recognition of the ongoing forms of slavery by another name that were put in place immediately after the institution of slavery was abolished formally, and then the real historical legacy of what we left formerly enslaved people with, which was a real impoverished notion of freedom that locked them into a second-class status in this country that has had political, economic, and legal implications really since 1865.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about the disparities that you mentioned, and I want to play a piece of testimony from Ta-Nehisi Coates. He has written about the case for reparations in the past and was one of the people who testified last week about this. Here's Ta-Nehisi Coates.
The typical black family in this country has one-tenth the wealth of the typical white family. Black women die in childbirth at four times the rate of white women. And there is, of course, the shame of this land of the free, boasting the largest prison population on the planet, of which the descendants of the enslaved make up the largest share. The matter of reparations is one of making amends and direct redress, but it is also a question of citizenship. In H.R. 40, this body has a chance to both make good on its 2009 apology for enslavement and reject fair-weather patriotism. To say that a nation is both its credits and its debits.
So really, in short here, what Ta-Nehisi Coates is testifying about is, once again, those disparities that we just, you know, mentioned a minute ago. But it also brings the conversation of reparations and slavery into more present day ways of considering, you know, how this has had, you know, a ripple effect through our own history. When you hear testimony like that, you know, how do you think that resonates with people who are, you know, tuning into this conversation, maybe even for the first time?
Well, I think for a lot of people, this is a somewhat new issue. And I think the issue of slavery is one where we studied in middle school and we're told that we fought a civil war over it. And then we passed the 13th Amendment and ended slavery. And that was all there was to tell about it. And what we're starting to hear from people like Ta-Nehisi Coates, but from others who've been at this work for a very long time, is a much more complicated story. And I think what's significant about this issue coming up in the Congress, but also among almost all of the Democratic candidates for the presidency, is an enriched national conversation about the legacy of slavery and how we're still living with it today in a numerous way. So it's nice to see this issue break out into the open. And for those of us who've been working on it a long time, these are familiar facts. It's a familiar set of concerns about a national legacy of slavery. But for some folks, it's new news. It's a new way of thinking about racism and white supremacy. And we have to keep talking about it and deepen the conversation to bring those who are new to it along in this struggle.
We're talking to Catherine Franke right now. She is a professor at Columbia Law School, and she's the author of Repair, Redeeming the Promise of Abolition. And she's with us to talk about this growing conversation about reparations, which is either through money or resource redistribution, a way to narrow the gap and basically address slavery in a way that we haven't really in this country so far. And, you know, the day ahead of this testimony, you know, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was asked whether or not he supported reparations. So again, for our listeners, this was before the testimony started, and this is what he had to say.
I don't think reparations for something that happened 150 years ago for whom none of us currently living are responsible is a good idea. We've tried to deal with our original sin of slavery by fighting a civil war, by passing landmark civil rights legislation. We've elected an African-American president. I think we're always a work in progress in this country, but no one currently alive was responsible for that.
Again, that was Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and that was his answer when he was asked about whether or not he supported reparations. You know, where does his line of thinking fall into what some people have thought about reparations previously?
Well, it's interesting that he would say that there is no relevance to this discussion today since slavery formally ended 150 years ago, just as we're going into celebrating the 4th of July. So there are countless ways in which we annually come together and celebrate moments from our past, see those moments as really formative for who we are as a people today. You know, there are no baseball games that begin without us standing up and saying the Pledge of Allegiance and honoring our nation's history. And so there's some history that we're happy to hold on to, and there's other history that we choose to forget. And part of what this national conversation today is that our national history is complicated for better and for worse. And it's that hard part, the worst part, that the reparations discussion is trying to bring back out into the open so that the history of slavery doesn't remain just a dead fact in the past, becomes a more active part of our current memory.
We're talking to Catherine Franke of Columbia Law School about reparations for descendants of slaves. And that is after a House subcommittee invited testimony on the issue last week.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the idea of reparations for descendants of slavery? Do you think that this is the right way to address economic disparities in the African-American community? Do you have questions about how a reparations program would work? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Chris Molina. We're continuing our conversation about reparations, the political debate over them, and what a possible reparations program could look like. Catherine Franke of the Columbia Law School is our guest.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about reparations? Would you support a reparations program? Why or why not? Call 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, Catherine, we talked about the fact that this call for reparations it's not coming from nowhere. There's actually a fair amount of historical precedent for this. Can you talk a little bit about the debate over reparations and what they look like right after the Civil War?
Absolutely. And then so much that I think is important about the current discussion around reparations is knowing this history. So as the Northern military moved through the South, occupying various areas in the Confederacy, there are a couple of places in particular, the Sea Islands in South Carolina and several plantations outside Vicksburg, Mississippi, where Northern military leaders saw the state of the enslaved people as they fled the plantations to safety of the Northern military units. These people were poor, they were hungry, they'd been whipped, so they were scarred. They were just emotionally devastated from the violence of slavery. And what the Northern military officials instantly recognized is something was owed to freed people more than mere emancipation. You know, absolutely we should abolish the institution of slavery and free the slaves, but we needed to do more than that. And these Northern military officials, were convinced that reparations, and they use that term, reparations, were owed to freed people, both to recognize retroactively the horror, the death, the torture, the separation of families, the rape that slavery was about, but also prospectively, for freedom to actually have any meaning, people needed material resources. You know, the freed people were illiterate. They couldn't read or write because it was illegal to teach them to read or write when they were enslaved. They had absolutely no money. And so what the military officials said is that these people actually have a mortgage on the land, a moral mortgage on the land that is owed to them as reparations. And this is where we get this idea of 40 acres and a mule, is that land was allocated to freed people as reparations at the immediate end of the Civil War, and all that land was stolen from them when President Lincoln was assassinated and the new president, Andrew Johnson, restored property rights to the former slave owners. And so we had a very short period during the middle to the end of the Civil War where black people were actually given reparations as a moral imperative, and that ended with Lincoln's death. And that wound, that ongoing wound, we're still living with.
So given the fact that, you know, basically the reparations lasted for an extremely short amount of time, were there any other politicians at the time that picked up the mantle, or was it just sort of left to fade away?
There were a few politicians who continued to introduce in Congress and in public discussion and in the media the idea of an ongoing obligation to repair the horror of slavery, and of course that there were African-American people themselves. Frederick Douglass talked about it. A number of African-American leaders talked about reparations, and there were efforts to deliver both financial and land-based repair to formerly enslaved people, but none of those efforts actually succeeded.
So I want to go to our callers right now. We have Lynn in Ellison Bay. Hi, Lynn. What did you want to say?
Hi there. How are you?
I'm well. What's your question or comment?
Well, I was wondering, I never hear anything about the economic impact of reparations, and I'm wondering if there wouldn't be a huge positive economic impact, much more per se than tax cuts and things, in the sense that it would directly put money to the into areas where it's needed.
And Lynn, thank you so much for that call. And so Lynn gets to this point about investment sort of versus just a tax cut. What would a more active investment in terms of reparations look like in communities that are a little harder hit?
Well, one of the things that I recommend in Repair, the book on reparations that just came out, is that we use the estate tax as a way to find the money to pay for reparations. My generation of people in their 50s, 60s are standing to inherit huge sums of money. It's actually the largest intergenerational transfer of wealth we've ever seen in humankind. And this is taking place right now as the great generation passes away and passes on their family fortunes to their kids. And much of those fortunes were accumulated through the ownership of land, a deal that black people never got in on. So the estate taxes are very, very low right now. We could raise those estate taxes and basically recoup what is, I feel, money that was held in trust for formerly enslaved people, and then use that money for collective remedies in the black community. I'm not as keen on writing individual checks only to people who can show a genetic descendants from enslaved people, but instead those black people in our society who have suffered from white supremacy and from the racism that is its expression could be collectively the beneficiaries of a number of measures, including community land trusts, which are this really creative way of bringing land and home ownership into community control. So there are a number of interesting experiments going on or being discussed about how we might move money into the black community to empower it rather than to just write checks to individual black people.
And those other potentials, how much have those been actually discussed? Because when we frequently hear about reparations, it's just that, cut a check and give it away. But that's not exactly what many people are looking for, right?
Well, there's been a very rich discussion about reparations might look like. You know, if you look at the South African example or other places around the world where we've engaged in discussions about reparations more recently, many different means of repair have been used. And so those conversations have happened in the United States, but among a very small number of people, and a lot of very creative thinking has gone into what reparations might look like. And that's why passage of this bill in Congress is so important, where those ideas can be debated and considered and recommendations can be made to Congress that are much more complicated than some of the more simple things that we've heard circulate in the media more recently.
I want to go back to our callers right now. We have Grace in Bayfield. Hi, Grace.
Hi, this is Grace. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate this topic. I strongly want to support reparations. And I'm sorry, the reason I called is I care for my mother, and she's elderly, and she can't really talk well on the phone. But she said to me, so what are we going to do reparations for the Native Americans?
And Grace, thank you so much for that call. Catherine, that is a comment that we have seen a lot today, too, which is people who want to support reparations, but they see all of the other injustices in our own history, in particular for Indigenous communities. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, Grace, that is such an important thing to raise, and it came to my mind several times during the hearings on the bill in Congress last week. Because so often you hear people say that slavery was America's original sin, but of course it wasn't. It was the conquest and genocide and violence and dispossession of Native Americans, you know, toward the Native Americans by European settlers, that was our original sin. And that's not to diminish in any way the violence of slavery, but this country was founded on a number of forms of violence, slavery and the dispossession or treatment of Native Americans, both being, I think, primarily important. So I have actually been working with several Native American leaders in the Northeast on this issue, and I think the issue of reparations looks quite different for Native people than it does for African Americans. I think sovereignty, you know, recognizing Native people as sovereign nations is part of what we need to do to repair the injury of conquest when Europeans settled in the U.S. or in North America. And so our reparations for slavery may look a little bit differently. But, you know, we're smart people, all of us in this country. We can have two discussions at the same time. The one need not happen in a way that somehow eclipses the need to address both issues.
Yeah, and it sort of goes back to what Ta-Nehisi Coates said in his testimony, that we are a nation of our credits and our debits, and that we can recognize a lot of things at once as part of the, you know, the growing part of our fabric of our country. Now, part of why we're talking about this is because, you know, we are just about a year away from the next presidential campaign. A lot of Democratic candidates have said, I support reparations. This is something we should do. Are you surprised to see that?
Well, I'm a little surprised to have seen it taken off as much as it has, because a year ago, no one was talking, or very few people in our national political culture were talking about the issue. And I think part of why we're seeing a difference is that we have people of color who are prominent politicians who are reflecting the demands of their constituencies, to be sure. But we also have one of the most frank and ugly racist in our political history in the White House. And I think that this is not to say that we have not had white supremacy or racism in our political culture before, but there are ways in which Donald Trump expresses white supremacy and racism that is more frank and more ugly than anyone we've seen before occupying that office. And I think it's made the need for a form of national repair all the more pressing, while we have politicians from the Democratic Party actually getting quite detailed about what we ought to do.
In the last 30 seconds, how do you expect to see this conversation continue?
Well, there'll be a process in the Congress where this bill will get voted out of committee and then go to the full House, and I imagine it will pass the House. and then we'll have an issue in the Senate where we have a Republican Senate that may not bring it up. But the presidential campaigns will be addressing it more and more specifically, and I think generating a deeper national conversation about that form of repair for this ongoing historical wound.
Catherine, thank you so much for joining us today. That was Catherine Franke, the Sulzbacher Professor of Law and Gender and Sexuality Studies at Columbia University. She was with us today to discuss the political fight over reparations for descendants of slavery and how that discussion has changed throughout history. You can keep that conversation going on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Weekdays from 6 to 9, it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7, Wisconsin retailer Shopko has closed its final stores. The chain's failure affects 15,000 former workers and countless customers. Kate and her guest look at what happened. That's tomorrow at 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then Sesame Street has a new character, and she lives with a foster family. We'll take a look at the foster care system in Wisconsin. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Chris Molina. This is Central Time.